Tomorrow's the day we celebrate the birth of our country. News of the Declaration of Independence was released on July 4th, even though the act took place a couple of days earlier. The work in the hall in Philadelphia framed the revolution, but obviously many, many other events led to the United States becoming an independent country. Author Rick Atkinson opens a trilogy on the revolution with a book called The British Are Coming, The War for America, Lexington to Princeton, 1775 to 1777. Rick Atkinson has a pile of books and a wall of awards to show for his work. He won a Pulitzer in History for An Army at Dawn, the first book in his World War II trilogy. He also won a pair of Pulitzers in Journalism for his work at the Kansas City Times and the Washington Post. Rick Atkinson, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Jeffrey.
So this book goes a lot further back in time than, for example, your World War II trilogy. Did it present some real difficulties in finding source material?
It did. It provided some difficulties in, first of all, understanding the historiography of the 18th century. I was accustomed to working in the 20th century and even early 21st century. So I had to teach myself what had been written about the Revolution, particularly in the era generally. The archives that I felt that I'd mastered pretty well for 15 years of work on the American role in the liberation of Europe in World War II were basically useless to me for this topic, because they're different archives than the archives where the materials from the American Revolution are kept. So, yeah, there were some real challenges as a narrative writer and as a historian. And then, you know, there were 16.1 million Americans in uniform in World War II in a country of 130 million people. In the American Revolution, there were maybe 200,000 who served over the course of 8 years in a country of 2.5 million. So there are a lot fewer footprints, and trying to tease out what happened and how it affected people and what they thought about it and so on is a lot harder when you've got that many fewer participants. Of that 2.5 million, I should also add 500,000 were black slaves, and they leave almost no footprint. So there are quite a few challenges to writing about something that happened 243 years ago.
With the material we're able to lay your hands on, though, I mean, there are some fairly common tropes about things that happened in the Revolutionary period. Did you find some daylight opening between the common telling of that time and what you now perceive to be the truth of it?
Oh, for sure. I wouldn't have done it if I didn't believe that there was some daylight. And in fact, there's a lot of daylight. I have always believed that the great events in history, just like the great people in history, are bottomless. There will always be more to discover, more to write about. People will be writing about Abraham Lincoln 500 years from now. And that's certainly true of World War II, and it's certainly true of the American Revolution. So, for example, Queen Elizabeth II owns the papers of our last king, George III, as well as the other three Georges who became king in the 18th and 19th centuries. And several years ago, for the first time, she opened up those papers of George III to scholars. For the first time, really, anybody had been able to get in to Windsor Castle, where they're kept. And I was among the first permitted in to see the papers and rummage through them. So every day I would go to the round tower begun by William the Conqueror in the 11th century and climb 102 stone steps and 21 wooden stairs, and I'd be in the garret of the round tower, and that's where the papers are kept. And I have to say that, first of all, it's thrilling. It's a very tactile sense of being in George's presence, because until late in life, when he began to go blind, he was his own secretary. He wrote his correspondence himself. He wrote the copies himself. He was a great list maker. He did a lot of scribbling, and there it is. And you can really feel like you're in his presence, and you can really feel as though you're understanding what he's thinking. What is he thinking in waging war against his own people for 8 years against 3,000, across 3,000 miles of open ocean? So that's one of a number of examples where I feel like I really broke some ground.
And I'll tell you, the opening sketch in the book is about George III, and it's really fascinating. The description of him as frugal in an age of excess and pious in a time of impiety, we certainly get an Eastern Atlantic view of why all those taxes and duties came down. What was going on? What spurred the British Empire to be reaching out for that much revenue?
Well, you put your finger on it. They were an empire. They had just become an empire with defeat of Spain and France in the Seven Years' War. We call it the French and Indian War. And the Treaty of 1763 created the first British Empire. It gave Britain Canada, gave them 500 million fertile acres west of the Appalachian Mountains, several rich sugar islands in the West Indies, pieces of India, Florida. And so George, who had become king in 1760 at the age of 22, was determined that this great empire, which has fallen to him, is going to be maintained on his watch. He's not going to lose the British Empire. And he believes that if the American insurrection is permitted to succeed, if the colonies are permitted to slip away, that it will encourage insurrections in Ireland, in Canada, in the Sugar Islands in the West Indies, in India, and that it will be the dissolution of the British Empire, and Britain will sink into primitive insignificancy. That's the phrase that they used. So it's the animating strategic principle that is behind their decision to make war and to keep making war for 8 years. It's quite wrong. It's a version of the domino theory that propels us into
Vietnam. Exactly the words coming to my mind. They didn't call it the domino theory, but yes.
Exactly. That's what it is. It's an 18th century version of it. And it's one of several strategic miscalculations that the king and his ministers and their majorities in Parliament hold. They believe, for example, that a substantial majority of Americans, of the 2 million white Americans, are loyalists. And they are not. It's a much smaller percentage, maybe 20%. So that's when you're predicating your strategy on the basis of inaccuracies, that's going to cause you problems.
Miscalculation, insurrection, revolution, and finally independence, discussed in Rick Atkinson's trilogy, of which we have one book done. The British Are Coming, The War for America, Lexington to Princeton, 1775 to 1777. We have Rick Atkinson with us. We'll come back and take more discussion with him and take phone calls and emails from you when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 15. The tea tax and the Boston Tea Party that it produced, here again, I'm just fascinated by what you discovered on the other side of the Atlantic. What was the reaction to the Boston Tea Party in England?
Outrage. Total outrage. Things had been building to a head over some years. The British were trying to recoup some of the money that they had spent on the 7 Years' War. They were in debt. The war had been very expensive to them. There was some concern that Britain might be bankrupt. That was not true, but there was anxiety about it. And so they had tried to impose some relatively minor taxes on the colonists on the theory that we, the Americans, had benefited from victory in the 7 Years' War and that we were continuing to benefit from the British troops that were stationed here to keep peace on the frontier, keeping the French and the Spanish away from our coastline and so on. And we had famously resisted, believing that taxation without representation was improper at best. And these taxes were rescinded, except for a very small tax on tea, which in part was to prop up the British East India Company, which was bankrupt. The rebels in Boston particularly objected to this, and again, famously, in December 1773, went down to Boston Harbor, where there was a ship just jammed with very expensive tea, and threw it into the harbor. When George III found out about that, he shared the outrage that most Englishmen felt toward this act of desecration, toward this vandalism. And it's really at that point that, he says blows must decide. And it's at that point that the spiraling descent into war accelerates, and it will be 16 months later that war erupts at Lexington and Concord.
Benjamin Franklin was living in London at that time and got a punishment that really amounted to, almost like a public pants-down spanking. What did he do to provoke that?
Yeah, no no one was a greater enthusiast for the British Empire than Benjamin Franklin in the 1760s. He had cut short a vacation on the European continent to come back for George III's coronation. He was that enamored of the monarchy, but he had gradually become disaffected over time, and by 1775, we're going to see that he's a real radical. He's thrown in his lot with those who are willing to overthrow British tyranny, as they see it. Franklin was given some letters, and they were very sensitive letters that had been written by a British official in New England. And they were excessively candid in talking about, well, if necessary, we can suspend the rights of these rebellious Americans in New England. Franklin sent the letters back to Boston with the notation, these ought not be made public. Well, they were immediately published. There was a big uproar in London. There were duels fought over this scandal. Franklin finally admitted that he was the one responsible for the release of these letters. He was dragged before the Privy Council, which is a very high-ranking advisory board to the king. And it was like a public spanking. It was a public shaming. For more than an hour, the Solicitor General just ripped into Franklin, accused him of scandalous behavior, treason, of not being a gentleman, which really stung. And it completed Franklin's radicalization. He remained in London for another year, trying back-channel means to find a means to avert war unsuccessfully, and finally sailed for America in the early spring of 1775. While he was at sea, headed to Philadelphia, a war began with the Lexington and Concord brawl. And by the time he arrives back in Philadelphia, his radicalization has been completed.
So to the book's title, Rick Atkinson's our guest. His book is called The British Are Coming. Did Paul Revere actually say the British are coming?
No, he almost certainly did not. It wouldn't have made much sense to people who still thought of themselves as British citizens on April 19th, 1775, when he makes his famous ride into the countryside. What he is quoted as saying over and over again in a very loud voice is, the regulars are coming out, the regulars are coming out, the regulars, meaning the British Army regulars, coming out of Boston, headed for Concord. I use the phrase, which Longfellow made famous in his poem in the 19th century, because it's really what the first couple of years of the war are about. The British are coming. They're bringing a majority of one of the finest armies in the world. They're bringing a very substantial portion of the greatest navy the world has ever seen. They're bringing 30,000 German mercenaries, the Hessians, and they're coming to kill your men, to rape your women, to pillage your homes, and in some cases to burn your towns. It's a very dire thing, and it's exactly what we're facing in 1775-76.
Why were those areas focused upon? Why were the regulars coming to the likes of Lexington and Concord?
Well, Boston was the seat of insurrection. There's no doubt about that. And they'd been troublesome for years. We talked about the Tea Party in December 73. Thomas Gage, who was the British general who was the senior officer in North America and was the colonial governor also at the time, was told by his political masters in London that you need to do something about this. You need to tamp it down. He received orders in April of 1775. You will take your troops, and it was suggested that he try to capture the rebel leaders. He realizes that chasing them all over Massachusetts makes little sense. So what he decides to do, General Gage, is to take a large armed column to Concord, where he has good intelligence and knows that the rebels have stashed munitions, including cannons and gunpowder. And so they set out famously on the night of April 18th with the intent of marching. It's about 18 miles to Concord to seize this stuff and to teach the rascals a lesson. They encounter a small militia group in Lexington, which is 6 miles short of Concord. A shot is fired. No one knows who fired the first shot. the British soldiers, quite undisciplined, begin firing randomly, 2 or 3 minutes to get them under control by their officers. And at the end of that fusillade, the rebels have 8 dead and 10 wounded lying there on Lexington Green. And then they proceed on to Concord. So that was the event that started the war. By the time they get to Concord, of course, the Americans are ready for them. The British are heavily outnumbered. Eventually, they're going to be about 4,000 Americans taking shots at them as they try to get back to Boston, this long afternoon of marching from Concord back to Boston. Heavy casualties on both sides. It's the beginning of the revolution, and 8 years later, we will have emerged from it with a new country and our independence intact.
No great love, obviously, for the Americans from the British soldiers. You relate in the book some of the rewritings of the old Yankee Doodle song that was first heard in the 1760s. One version is Yankee Doodle came to town for to buy a firelock. We will tar and feather him, and so we will John Hancock. Am I guessing correctly that there are other verses we probably can't share on the radio?
Soldiers will be soldiers. Yeah, sure, there were some bawdy versions of it. It had been a British song, and it was intended derisively, and it certainly reflected the derision that many British soldiers felt toward this rabble they were fighting. And then it was appropriated by the Americans. We kind of pinched their song, and it proudly became the anthem of the American Revolution, with lyrics that more reflected the patriotism of those who were singing it at the time. But yeah, there were hard feelings, as always is the case when you're killing each other, and the derision that the British soldier typically felt for the Americans was tempered after a while, because they realized, first of all, that the Americans were tougher fighters than they had hoped, second, they recognized that this, what they had hoped would be a quick, efficient war, was going to be anything but, that they were in it for the long haul. If you were a British soldier, you were typically in the army for life. For some of them, that was going to mean, as it turned out, fighting in America for years and years. So the relationship between opposing armies is a pretty complex thing.
Indeed. We're talking to Rick Atkinson, a Pulitzer Prize winner in history and in journalism, about his latest book, The British Are Coming, The War for America, Lexington to Princeton, 1775 to 1777. You can join the conversation here on the Jefferson Exchange. It's 800-838-3760 for your thoughts and questions. And you can also send emails to jx@jeffnet.org. Waiting patiently, Don in Eugene, welcome to the Exchange.
Oh, good morning, Jeff. We had an ancestor who died at Kings Mountain, which was an interesting battle. But I wanted to ask, this is absolutely fascinating. It's about Oregon, the word Oregon. And there was a fellow who helped win the French-Indian War for the Colonials, Robert Rogers, who adopted guerrilla tactics and was the nemesis of the British or the French, and he was later up in Michigan. Apparently, heard the Travailler talking about the River Ourogon, which is a Caribbean word adopted by the French, ouragan, meaning hurricane, and windstorm. The Native Americans apparently called the Columbia the River of Storms because of the dust storms on the east side. And the French, the Quebecois, the trappers who would go on, you know, westward with their Indian friends, girlfriends, would encounter Native Americans who talked about the River of the West as the River of Storms. And they would come to Robert Rogers' trading post up in Michigan, where he'd been banished. And they talked about the River of the West, and the Travailler would say, oh, the Rivière Ourogon, which in a book by, I can't remember the guy's name, called Explorations of the Northwest, they sent a letter to the king, old George, and asked, you know, we should probably explore explore this Oregon or Oregon. They wrote it both ways, about four different ways. And that letter is somewhere. And my question to you is, how can we find that letter to demonstrate the origin?
You're asking probably the right person. Let's find out. Thanks for that, Don. Rick?
I'm not sure you are asking the right person. My Oregon history, I had just had the pleasure of being out and speaking at the Oregon Historical Society in Portland a few weeks ago. I should have asked them. Rogers, you mentioned, is a very interesting figure. He's considered the founding father of our Rangers today, Special Forces units, highly trained, highly skilled. And he was a large figure in the French and Indian War. Unfortunately, during the American Revolution, he remained a loyalist, and he was arrested at one point. Washington ordered him arrested. He was sent to Philadelphia to be interrogated by the Congress, and he escaped. And he will be a thorn in the side. So he may be the spiritual father of Oregon, but he is not one of the fathers of the country. I can say that with some certainty. Huh. I don't know where you would find that letter. I've started the Oregon Historical Society, I think. If such a thing exists, they probably would know about it. You can call Carrie, the director there, and I suspect that would be the best place to start.
Thanks for that, Rick, and thank you for the question, Don. Let's come back to the story in Boston, because the Battle of Bunker Hill pretty soon after the opening of hostilities. Now, the Brits had Boston under siege, and it's not just that it was a soldier-to-soldier battle. What were they doing to neighborhoods? What kind of stuff were they raining down on Charlestown, for example?
Well, the British occupied Boston after they were chased back into Boston from Concord at the beginning of the war, and Washington came and would take command of the new Continental Army in early July of 1775, as they laid siege, basically, to Boston right until March of 1776. Between the time that Lexington Concord happened and the time that Washington took command, there was a famous battle called Bunker Hill. It was June 17th, 1775, where the British were trying to get some elbow room. They were trying to expand their rather narrow hold on Boston. And the high ground across the Charles River on the other side of the little town of Charlestown consisted of two hills, Breed's Hill and the higher Bunker Hill. And the Americans decided they were going to fortify this peninsula. The British woke up one morning. They've heard odd sounds of excavation during the night. When the sun rises on this summer day, they see that, in fact, there are hundreds of Americans digging and creating fortifications. That leads to a direct assault by British forces in one of the most ferocious battles of the whole war. The British will have 1,000 casualties, 256 dead. Of all the British officers killed in 8 years of war, one in eight of them will die in 4 hours at Bunker Hill. During the battle, the decision is made to bombard Charleston, right across the Charles River from Charlestown, right across the river from Boston, and bombardment begins with cannons from Boston and from Royal Navy ships. The town catches fire. The town burns to ashes. It's not the last town that the British will burn. And, of course, it incites people. It incites the Americans. The sight of this town burning, the churches burning, the houses burning, the wharves, the docks, the shipyards, and so on. So that's part of the Battle of Bunker Hill. And, you have to say, when word spreads south through the colonies that the British are setting fire to our towns, all it does is to make people angrier and more determined that they're going to fight.
So Bunker Hill certainly felt like a defeat up to a point, but seen as otherwise soon after. How long after Bunker Hill did Washington arrive on the scene?
2 weeks. Uh-huh. He had been a member of Congress from Virginia. He'd had 5 years of experience in uniform as a militia colonel from Virginia, always under superior British command during the French and Indian War. He had a fair amount of combat experience. He'd been with his British commander when he was killed, and the fact that he had these 5 years of experience, even though he'd been out of uniform for the better part of 20 years, is one of the main reasons why he was consequently given command of the Continental Army. He had a lot to learn. He had a lot to remember because it had been a long time, and there's a lot he didn't know. And so that's part of this early story of the Revolution, is Washington trying to learn to become a commander, learn to become a leader, actually. That begins in the summer of 1775.
We will pick the story up there when we come back to talk more with Rick Atkinson. His book is The British Are Coming. This is the Jefferson Exchange, back in a minute five. William, no town given, who adds to the Yankee Doodle verses with one that goes like this. There was Captain Washington upon a snow-white charger. He looked as big as all outdoors and thought that he was larger. I'd heard many things in the past about Washington's doubts about his own work, or people having doubts about him, perhaps. And he certainly had doubts about the army he took over. He wrote himself, as you point out, in July of 1775, confusion and discord reigned in every department. What did he have to do to shape this army up?
Yeah, and what did the army have to do to shape him up? Because it was a two-way street, actually. Mm-hmm. Well, he arrives, Jeffrey, as I said, a lot he doesn't know, a lot that he's forgotten about commanding an army, about commanding men in combat. And he has nothing good to say about the New Englanders he's commanding. The Continental Army is primarily a New England army at this point. He's a Virginian. And the fact that a Virginian has been placed in command of this army is part of Congress's effort to unify the country by mixing together different regions. The colonies were almost different countries at that point. He talks about dirty New Englanders. He has nothing good to say about the junior officers that he sees there. Part of the issue is that Washington really does not have an understanding of the sacrifices being made by these farmers and shopkeepers in leaving their farms and their shops and their families to serve at his side, to serve the cause. He's got 200 slaves back in Mount Vernon running, taking care of business while he's away. And it's going to take him a while to understand that there is a mystical bond between leader and led, and that he is going to have to understand in his bones what these men are giving up for him. And they're going to have to know that he knows that. So this is a complex relationship, and it's going to take some time to develop. Meanwhile, Washington's got to learn his skills, not only as a battlefield commander, but he's basically his own staff at this point. He's his own intelligence chief. He's his own quartermaster. He's his clothier general. He's down in the weeds of necessity because he has virtually no staff when he first arrives in Cambridge, and it's going to persist that way for a while. So he's got to learn about this. He's a natural political general, probably the best in American history, with the possible exception of Dwight Eisenhower, whom I had the privilege of spending 15 years with metaphorically. They're very similar in some ways. Political, I mean, not partisan politics, of course, but political in the sense that he has a keen understanding of his political masters. Washington immediately writes many letters to members of Congress, to colonial governors, to committees of safety. First of all, he's assuring them that they are his political masters. This is a very fraught subject in the 18th century, concern about a man on horseback taking command of the country, as Cromwell had done in Britain. And he is very reassuring on that account. It's a great gift he gave to us. He's making it up as he goes along. And he's also political in the sense that he's got a great capacity for motivating both the superiors and inferiors, and of looking to get what he needs, and of providing the information that they need for decision-making. And he's just a naturally gifted political general, and that is not a slur. So watching this develop in the first couple of years of the revolution, first of all, it's an important part of the book, and second, it's an important part of the ultimate success that the Americans are going to have in the revolution.
I was struck by the details that I had never heard before about how it was that Washington chose to deliver the news of the Declaration of Independence to his troops, which didn't arrive, I think, until July 9th or so.
Yeah, he's in New York at that point, and the news does arrive. A copy of the Declaration is sent to his headquarters in New York. He orders all of his men late in the day to assemble on various parade grounds in and around Manhattan Island, and he has adjutants read the Declaration as the men are in ranks. If you've ever listened to the Declaration read aloud, first of all, the men are grateful, I think, for the fact that Congress has severely edited Jefferson's original manuscript. They cut it by about a third, and it's still pretty tedious in spots because it lists innumerable grievances against Britain. The beginning of it is, among the most famous passages in our language. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. And Washington wants his men to hear this to have a clearer understanding of what it is that they're fighting for. Even the most unlettered private could recognize that there's something majestic in the air as the beginning of this great oration is read out to them. So in lower Manhattan, the locals, including some soldiers, immediately reply by going down after the Declaration has been read and throwing a rope around the large equestrian statue of George III, pulling it off its plinth and smashing it to pieces, carting off the pieces, melting it down, and they made 42,000 bullets out of it.
But this is an example of the genius you were talking about of Washington, is that he understood the political workings in addition to the military ones, and how his role and the role of the people he supervised fit in with an overall picture.
Yes. He's got a big brain. Again, he reminds me of Eisenhower in that respect. He's got a brain organized for executive action, an adhesive memory, very capable writer. There's never any doubt when you leave his presence of what it is that he wants you to do. And he's got a knack for understanding that the political underpinnings of this movement, this rather inchoate lurch toward a republic, are critically important to what he's trying to do militarily. That he, among other things, has got to rely on the individual colonies, and they will be states after July of 1776, for the men, the material, everything that he needs from bullets to bacon, and that he's got to help weave it together. And he's also the chief strategist for the... There's no joint chiefs, there's no Defense Department, there's no National Security Council. He is all of that. He is basically deciding how the war is going to be fought, how best to take it to the British Empire, and how best to ensure that the cause will not perish despite a number of setbacks on the battlefield, partly because he's not a particularly gifted battlefield general, but he's got other skills that help to compensate for that.
Let's take a call here about George Washington from Peter in Grants Pass. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Rick Atkinson, the author of The British Are Coming.
Hi there. Thank you for taking my call. I thought it was important to comment on how we're talking about General Washington's generalship, that after Bunker Hill and Breed's Hill, it was pretty much all downhill, the fall of New York, the retreat through New Jersey, and it was just really looking terrible for the rebel army, and that General Washington got exceptionally lucky with the crossing of the Delaware, as by that time a lot of his army was... Their enlistment was up at the end of the year, and had they not won that battle, and George Washington got really lucky with that, that kind of saved the revolution, because after the fall of New York, you know, the British were there for the entirety of the war after that.
Right, until 1783.
Yeah.
All right. So thanks for that perspective, Peter. Appreciate that. Rick, can you pick it up there? Was it things looking bleak at the end of 1776?
Washington wrote as he's retreating across New Jersey and across the Delaware westbound into Pennsylvania, the game is pretty near up. Things are bleak. He has not really won a battle since he's become commander-in-chief. He has forced the British out of Boston. He's done that more by maneuver, and he does have some luck. There's no doubt about that, but what is the trait that Napoleon most cherishes in his generals? It's luck, and it's not to be underestimated in life and certainly not in war, and Washington is lucky. So that's what you want in your generals. Again, he is learning as he goes along. His training, his experience is in pitched direct combat. That's the European way. That's what he has learned as a militia colonel under a British tutelage. And he realizes, particularly after the catastrophe at Long Island, where he's driven out of Long Island across the East River, again, a lucky, narrow escape, and then he's driven out of Manhattan. He has 3,000 men captured or killed at Fort Washington, north of Harlem. He realizes that he's not going to be able to slug it out toe-to-toe. He's going to have to really pick his spots when he wants to fight the British and slug it out with volleys of musket fire, and that otherwise he's going to have to fight a rather defensive war in which he picks the ground to the extent he can. He picks the time. He heckles and harasses the British from the side. He knows that in an insurrection, we've seen this in Vietnam, in Afghanistan, in Iraq, in an insurrection, the home team has the advantage in the sense that their main objective is not to lose. If you're waging expeditionary war, you're sending your armies great distances away, as the British were in the 1770s, or as we did in those other wars, more recent wars I mentioned, your objective is to win. You've got to win. You can't just not lose. And so Washington takes that insight, I think, and folds it into his generalship, and that becomes part and parcel of how he's going to wage war. It's kind of a Washington way of war that we will see for the next several years.
We've certainly given Washington a fair amount of time here. I want to talk about somebody else, though, on the other side of the Atlantic. Edmund Burke, the father of conservatism, gave a long speech in the House of Commons about what in relation to the war?
Well, Edmund Burke is Anglo-Irish. He's one of the great political philosophers of the 18th century. He's an elegant orator, although he's got such a thick Irish brogue that some of his fellow parliamentarians have trouble understanding what it is that he's saying. And he gives several impassioned speeches in the early parts of the revolution, and he essentially is arguing against waging war against the colonies. He's got a belief, and the belief is shared, for example, by Adam Smith, who's writing The Wealth of Nations. He's a great Scottish political philosopher and economist. That book will be published in 1776, who also believes, as Burke does, that it doesn't make any sense to try and pursue this war, this counter-insurrection, given all the difficulties and given the political righteousness of the American cause. Burke sees the majesty of it. Burke is an admirer of it. Another guy who is aligned with him in this respect is the Earl of Chatham, who has been the architect of British victory in the Seven Years' War. He's old, he's feeble, he's dying at this point, but he also gives a couple of impassioned speeches in Parliament in which he says, this makes no sense what we're trying to do here. So there are some big brains and big voices aligned against the royal policy, against the king and his ministers, but they are a distinct minority, and the king will maintain large majorities in both the House of Lords and the House of Commons until virtually the end of the war.
We only have about a minute left here, Rick, and I just want to ask about Tom Paine, because you point out that he failed at pretty much everything in his life except the pamphlet Common Sense. Was there a lot of that in this revolution, people who rose to the moment and perhaps didn't make a mark anywhere else in their lives?
You know, Jeffrey, I think that's a good insight. It's a time of ascendancy. You take a Boston bookseller, 25-year-old overweight guy named Henry Knox, and next thing you know, he's the father of American artillery. You take a Rhode Island Quaker anchorsmith named Nathaniel Greene, who's a private in the militia, and the next thing you know, he's one of the greatest generals the American Army will ever produce. Tom Paine is another example. He's failed at everything he's ever tried in life. He comes to America, and all of a sudden, he's got his chance. He's not going to miss his shot, to quote the line from Hamilton.
Right. The book is called The British Are Coming, The War for America, Lexington to Princeton, 1775 to 1777, Volume 1 of the Revolution Trilogy by Rick Atkinson. Rick, thank you so much.
Thank you, Jeffrey.
Take care. That'll do it for today's exchange. We're online at jeffexchange.org. Our producers, John Baxter and April Ehrlich of JPR News, Randy Babbitt at the controls. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening. Join us next time on The Exchange. Have a great and safe Independence Day weekend.